You are listening to a session from the Sunstone 2013 Salt Lake City Symposium at the University of Utah. This particular session was recorded on August 1st, 2013, and is titled, Just What is Spirituality? Presented by Dan Witherspoon, Phyllis Barber, Robert A. Reese, and Katie Langston. Sunstone depends on your generous support to fund projects like this podcast and other important endeavors in Mormon culture, scholarship, and restorationist pursuits. Please consider a donation at sunstonemagazine.com.
This is section 132. Okay, this is section 132. What is spirituality? I am supposed to instruct you all to turn off any possible noisemakers. We have a very distinguished panel. Dan Witherspoon is well known for his podcast, Mormon Matters, and for his continual concern about creating harmony between diverse ways of thinking and worshiping. He served as the editor of Sunstone from 2001 to 2008. He is the editor of a forthcoming book by Francis Menloff called The Challenge of Honesty, so look for that. Phyllis Barber is the author of many books, both of fiction and of autobiography. And she has a new book coming out in 2014, Gentle Fire, A Spiritual Odyssey. The lead essay in this book is titled Searching for Spirit, and her presentation on the panel will stem from her journey to discover spirit during a 20-year hiatus from Mormonism and to participate with many different spiritual practices. Robert Reese is a visiting professor of Mormon studies at the Graduate Theological Union and UC Berkeley. He is a member of the Dialogue Board, served as Dialogue editor from 1972 to 1976. He is the editor of Why I Stay, The Challenges of Discipleship for Contemporary Mormons. That was published by Signature in 2011. And Katie Langston is a business communications specialist in the process of working toward a dual master's degree in marriage and family therapy at St. Mary's University of Minnesota and theology at Luther Seminary in St. Paul. She is a practitioner of mindfulness meditation. Okay, we will proceed. We hope to have time for questions afterwards.
Everybody. Phyllis is the one who created this panel. She's the person behind it. And it was interesting as I was going through all the different possible things that I might talk about here. The two or three things I'm going to say about all either originated with Phyllis or she helped give me articulate. Speak more into it. Or
it sounds like it's on from here.
You guys can. I'll just do more direct into it. So anyway, I owe a couple of just articulations to her that might come out today. One of them is just, here we are, we're in a session, we're going to talk about spirituality. And one of the most, very first thing I published in Sunstone when I was the editor in 2001 was a piece called Dancing with the Sacred by Phyllis Barber. And it opened with the following poem from Hafiz, who's a mystic from the 14th century. It says, I have 1,000 brilliant lies for the question, how are you? I have 1,000 brilliant lies for the question, what is God? If you think that truth can be known from words, if you think that the sun and the ocean can pass through that tiny opening called the mouth, well, somebody should start laughing. Somebody should start wildly laughing now. Anyone feel like joining us in a big, wild laughter right this minute as we begin this session? Because what we're going to do today is talk about that which can't be done. The Tao Te Ching, many of you know, and certainly different translations, but the opening section says, the Tao that can be told is not the eternal Tao. The name that can be named is not the eternal name. The unnameable is the eternally real. Naming is the origin of all particular things, all those thousand lies. You know, he's not talking about lying. He's just talking about we've separated it from its context. We've pulled it from fullness. What was embedded and always having that connection to each other. And so we kid ourselves that we can talk about who we are and how we are. We kid ourselves when we think we can talk about God. So naming is the origin of all particularity. Free from desire, however, we realize the mystery. Caught in desire, we only see the manifestations. So, I've asked Karen to really be careful, because I only have like two things that I really want to say out of all the thousand brilliant lies that I went through my brain preparing for this. There's only two things I want to do, and it's basically I want to link two ideas, but to get them, I want to share a little bit of a story about me coming to a sense of really, I would say, I've been on this journey for 25 years, and maybe the last dozen years or so, kind of sensing that I live a spiritual life, that I have an awareness of spirituality that's part of it. So just a little bit of a journey there, and in the telling of that journey, I want to make these two links. Like all kids, you want to be thought to be good or smart or whatever, and I had this naturally active brain. I had a great memory. I come from parents who are teachers. I have a dad who's blind who remembers everything by necessity, but somehow or other it passed off onto me. And so, of course, what do you want to do? You want to be the first in the class. You want to be, not only school class, but you want to do it in church and things like that. So I'm the kid with all of his hands up and things like that. And, so as you learn about things, you think that you know them, right? But the point is you don't experience them. And so it really wasn't until a period of intense brokenness, age 17 through 22, I kind of messed up my life pretty badly. And that kind of opened up some things to where actually the concepts that I could have answered any time in Sunday school or in priesthood meeting or anything like that all of a sudden began to feel things. And so I, began to have at least an understanding of a difference between knowledge and understanding, or between, what I believe and actually having the experience that drove the people to say those words that ultimately were the things that I confessed. And so that was it. But then I went back to school. I went back to study religion, of all things, in graduate school. And what does school want? Again, they want the answers. They want the theories. They want the external things. They want the different sorts of things. And so even though I had wonderful experiential knowledge, again, it was so easy to fall back into thinking that religion was all about, answers, or that it was more important to be able to offer a theoretical framing for something rather than just like trust the energies and things that I might be otherwise in touch with. So in my whole history of, 8 years of schooling from a master's on through a PhD in religion, I knew something was missing. As much as I love the theories and much as I engage them in so many things, something in them never captured the fullness of my experience. And I recognized that, and I even wrote my master's thesis on ritual and sort of why you feel empowered when you go through a ritual. And of course, what I was trying to do there was basically in an oblique way kind of make sense of what I had experienced in the temple. But somehow or other, going through this very basic story and enacting these roles and things like this, I was somehow empowered. I walked out of there feeling taller, feel oriented. What were these things? And so, of course, I took a theoretical approach to why ritual works, to send you into these different kinds of experiential modes and things like this. So that was a piece of it. But again, I'm still 8 or 9 years away from fully kind of owning the both andness of this, because again, when you're in school, you're delivering what school wants. So in the mix of all these things, though, there was one idea, and this is the first of like two ideas I want to link together for you. I encountered a fellow by the name of Fritz Stahl. He's a theorist, and he wrote a book called Rules Without Meaning. And it's basically a book about what the origins of religion are. in his mind and in his thing. And it was interesting that, you know, it had to do with ritual and myth, but I didn't engage it at all in my master's thesis, but it was just something that kind of constantly stuck with me throughout my entire schooling. And basically his thesis is that whatever religion is, you know, we tend to want to think about it as a set of beliefs, it's a set of ideas and things like this. He goes, no, it always begins in experience. You know, and so when he says rules without meaning, he says basically a person is wandering one day and their mind is in a contemplative mode and then boom, you know, they have some major experience. Or they're dancing, or they took this little magical berry, or whatever. They had an experience. And guess what? It's generally a good experience when it's a religious experience. There's always an expansiveness. Who knows what anyone's going to describe here? And we all probably look at all of our things here. And it's something that they want to repeat, right? So he says the origin of religion for him is simply experience. And here are the rules that I kind of, if I follow these, I'm more likely to have that experience again. Or I'm more likely to get myself into that mode again or something like this. And it's long, long, long before explanation comes along. It's long, long, long before you pose it. Oh, it must have been a God blessing me because he was pleased with me. Or it must have been, you know, something about the universe or something like that. So rules without meaning was his idea of we need to always focus right there. That every religion, no matter how it plays out and becomes codified later, it always begins in something where you can't describe it, you can't do any of those different things. So that's the first idea. The second idea is one, certainly I've been engaging it in somewhat an articulate way, but I really love the metaphor that I only discovered a few years ago. And it's by David Stendhal Roth, who's a Benedictine monk. He's a very interesting thinker and things like this, and you'll recognize that there's a tie between these two ideas. And he basically, he says that religions all start from an intense experience, you know, something that jars us, something that shifts us, something that brings about a mighty change in us. There's no other way to start a religion, and now I'm quoting. But he goes, I compare this to a volcano that gushes forth. And then the magma flows down the sides of the mountain and cools off. And when it reaches the bottom, it's just rocks. You'd never guess that there was fire in it. So after a couple hundred years or 2,000 years or more, what was once alive is dead rock. Doctrine becomes doctrinaire. Morals become moralistic. Rituals become ritualistic. What do we do with it? We have to push through this crust and go to the fire that's inside. See those connections there. So what is religion, or what is spirituality? Years ago, Sunstone, you were part of a session, I don't know if you organized it, but it was about writers and how to write personal memoir. And throughout this, and I believe it was Stephen Carter, I don't know if Stephen's here. I think it was him, yeah, there he is in the back. I think it was him that helped articulate what I'm going to just try to say now. And I'm still less than 5 minutes left.
You're okay.
Well, I want to know when
six
it's five.
Minutes.
Oh, okay, good. Good. I can go longer or shorter on this. He talked about the importance of a writer, especially in the memoir, something from their life or things like this. You need to make sure to, as much as possible, realize that whatever it is that's significant enough that you're going to use it in your writer, at one time was just this wildly chaotic, strange experience that you couldn't get your brain around, no matter what you try. It just simply was like, what is the meaning of this? So sort of a similar to the volcanic eruption. And then I believe he talked about, then he goes, there's a next stage where maybe it's a few hours later, or a day or two later, and you're talking with a trusted friend, somebody that's okay that you don't have all the answers figured out by this point, and you'll start spitballing with them, and you'll start, you know, you'll start telling them your different ideas and whatnot what was the possible meaning, but you're up in the air and you're still in this thing. So it's kind of like the molten magma, the molten flow here. It's still hot, but you're beginning to try to put meaning around it, right? And then he says, let's say that was because it was a spiritual experience and you're a Mormon and your next fast and testimony meeting, you know, the fire's within you to get up there. But you're not going to tell that chaotic version that you told your friend, are you? You're going to have picked a few points of meaning. And what you'll do there is you've now taken it from the fire of it to, you know, still there's obviously going to be some warmth and things there, but it's this is we fix something in our minds, in our memories, in whatever it is, in this process of doing it. And so what is the spiritual life? What is the journey of somebody who's active in a spiritual kind of thing? I believe Stephen says the writer, the best that the writer should be able to do is always try to go back between like point A and point B as much as possible. Get as close to the volcanic eruption as you can. Still go back into that place where there's possibilities. You know, maybe someone here will talk about emptiness as a concept or something that we experience. You know, what is emptiness? It's basically there's room for something else to flow into you. You know, so to get back to that thing where multiple meanings are still possible, where there's still that chance, you know, to live and to do those things. So instead of taming, instead of correlating our experiences and then trying to live there, I've had good luck in Sunday school conveying to people, you know, for instance, the phrase, I know that Jesus is the Christ. We hear it all the time, right? Ask them, though. You know, how often have you said that versus how often have you actually gone back to that place where you've felt the rescue. You felt, the soul felt its worth. I love that line from, you know, the Christmas, you know, song about that. How long has it been since you really did feel the emotions that would have led you to one day testify that Jesus is the Christ and things like that? So this whole idea of, you know, engaging religion, engaging phrases, engaging doctrines, engaging ideas in a place where you're more likely in between A and B, when the possibilities and things like that, that to me was the main point about spirituality and what it means. So in closing, I guess I wrote stuff obviously here, but you've seen me not even look down more than a couple times. But to live our lives more up the mountain, and it's interesting, Phyllis's book is actually, you got the old version because the publisher changed on it, it's called To the Mountain. Essays of a Mormon Seeker, something of a Mormon Seeker. Yeah. So that's the spirit. To live our lives more up the mountain, to as much as possible allow everything we carry with it have echoes of the original experience that led to the thought. Spirituality as backlighting, that glow that gives this mundane day-to-day interaction sort of worth, significance. A song that plays in the background. I grew up in San Diego, and when you're in San Diego, just kind of like with the Wasatch Front here, but San Diego, you always know where the ocean is. You always know where north is because you know where west is. And there's just that sort of sense that no matter where I was growing up in San Diego, I knew, even if I wasn't actively engaged, I knew where it was. There was something there. William James, in closing, you know, is my favorite philosopher. And he's just so articulate on, you know, guess what? Argumentation just doesn't get it done. You know, you can never argue your way to the full truth. There's somebody who always escape it. And he says, for my own part, I don't know what the sweat and blood of this life means. If it mean anything short of this, if this life be not a real fight in which something is eternally gained for the universe by success, it is no better than a game of private theatricals from which we may withdraw it what we will. So I don't know. I don't know if there's any significance, he's basically saying. But it feels like a real fight. As if there was something really wild in the universe which we, with all our idealities and faithfulness, are needed to redeem. Spirit, to me, that feeling that what I do matters, that is something I need, something I'm grateful that has become unhesitatingly part of me and my experience this past dozen years or so. Thank you.
If my voice is too soft, please let me know because I have a tendency to have a soft voice. The book that they mentioned coming out next year, it will be called To the Mountain, Memoir of a Spiritual Seeker. And it's coming out from Quest Books, which is Metaphysical Press, and I'm really excited to be a part of a larger dialogue. So, but the original title of the book was Searching for Spirit, so this is a subject that has fascinated me. May thy spirit be with us and guide us this day.
that they may always have the Spirit to be with them. Amen. What is this thing called Spirit? The thing we keep asking to be with and guide us as we offer our prayers. Is Spirit the same as God? Is it the essence from which God is made? Is Spirit a gender-specific thing, or is it greater than a pronoun or a noun or even language? I admit that when I think about it and try to capture Spirit in a container where I can observe, examine, and define it, it backs away and hides its face. It's not something that responds to demand. It can't be contained in mere words, as Dan has already said. Yet all of us are still curious, beseeching, imploring, entreating Spirit. Some say Spirit is in the wind, in the air we breathe. The Latin word spiritus, after all, means a breathing of wind. Are we spiritual by the very act of breathing? When we are an empty husk and breath is no longer ours, are we still inhabited by Spirit? Some say that Spirit is the activating or essential principle that gives life and light to physical organisms. The DNC says, "And the light which shineth, which giveth you light, is through him who enlighteneth your eyes, which is the same light that quickeneth your understanding." In its broadest connotation, spirituality can be said to be the purest of the moral, artistic, and intellectual aspirations of humanity. It is embedded in the ethics and philosophy of peoples and their nations. It can be said to affect the enlightened ways human beings treat each other, connect with nature, or create their art. In his foreword to the 2007 edition of the Best American Spiritual Writing, editor Philip Zaleski says, speaks about C.S. Lewis's life forking when, on a whim, he purchased from a railroad book rack, a worn copy of George MacDonald's Fantastics, and encountered for the first time that literary quality he later defined as holiness. How often I felt this holiness when reading a particular line of poetry or prose, something brought to life by a writer, composer, painter, or an articulate spokesperson, can offer an aha moment that can widen your heart and mind and open you to beauty inherent in every small thing. When I asked my friend Bonnie for her definition, she said spirituality is the sheer wonderment of the beauty and mystery of life and the cosmos. Yes, I thought when I read her email. What about the winter day I crunched through frigid snow in my fleece-lined boots and witnessed a white rainbow of ice crystals? What about the autumn day I hiked through a bower of brilliant orange, red, and yellow trees and saw fallen leaves swirling on the face of a slow-moving stream? What about the times I participated with a musical ensemble when everyone lets go of self and becomes greater than the individuals playing their instruments? That moment when the musicians followed the direction of spiritoso to transcend borders, when the music lifts off the notated page into something unspeakably harmonious and even luminous. When I felt this sheer connection to Spirit, it's like rising to a summit of feeling too powerful to withstand. It's like migrating birds changing direction at the same moment, all listening to some innate music and manifesting it against the backdrop of sky. When I asked myself to come up with my own definition, I remember reading something Ken Wilber wrote and thinking it was a rather perfect image of how I feel about spirituality. He writes of the great chain of being, explaining it as a nest within a nest within a nest, matter, mind, and soul held by the all-pervasive and loving embrace of an ever-present Spirit. Spirituality to me is a receiving of an awareness of this spiritual embrace from the ever-present Spirit. It is a circularity between humans and God, a divine giving, a receiving, and a giving back. As to the question of being spiritual with or without religion, I think that while spirituality can be and is found in the realm of a religious life where a gathering of people seek to live in harmony, where the act of worshiping and serving together is a symbol of one's reverence for all that is God, it is not the same thing as religion. Religion is a home, a vehicle, a framework for a life, a base of operation. It has been a point of departure for most of us here and implies that we worship as a body, even as a body of Christ, in a community of faith rather than as one individual practitioner. Religion at its best, as Brian McLaren says, can reconnect its followers not only to God, but with neighbor, with stranger, an enemy, with non-human life, with all creation. No doubt the distinction between the two gets tossed about freely in contemporary circles. Many times I've heard someone say that he or she is a spiritual person but not a religious one. Does a religious person naturally seek spirituality? Does a spiritual person need a religion? Terrell and Fiona Givens, in their recent book, The God Who Weeps, have this to say. Our current generation's preference for spirituality over religion is often a sleight of hand that confuses true discipleship with self-absorption. The new sensibility began innocently enough with a lyrical expression of William Blake, who suggested that God might be better found in the solitary contemplation of nature than in the crowded pews of church. He urged readers to see the world in a grain of sand and heaven in a wildflower, hold infinity in the palm of your hand and eternity in an hour. Then the Givens continue by saying that the cosmos revolves on comforting the sick. When you act in this way, you are sharing in the love which built the stars. Holiness is found in how we treat others, not in how we contemplate the cosmos. End of that quote. I agree that how we treat our fellow human beings is a strong component of spirituality, but is it spirituality itself? I like to think of spirituality as the presence behind the act of religion, the source of devotion and an openness to the guidance of the ever-present spirit. Though spirituality can be nourished amply within and is intertwined with religion, I believe it can stand alone without the architecture of a religious structure. It is rather the fuel for the vehicle of religion. It is the impulse behind charity and needs to be considered above rationality and across a wider spectrum of thought. It is the questing not only by Latter-day Saints, but Catholics and Sufi mystics, rabbis, poets, and composers, among others, to connect with the divine, however possible. It is a questing, writes Arthur Bassett, by people who have sought for and found meaning in the love of God and fellow human beings. Granted, questing and contemplation are not the same as doing, but is there room for the quiet, silent approach to spirituality, the contemplative life, or is it all about doing, the old debate about grace versus works? Maybe Blake wasn't talking so much about abandoning church pews and finding all the answers to the cosmic mysteries in a laissez-faire, sit-by-the-side-of-the-road glimpse of a grain of sand or wildflower, but rather was talking about how we observe the wildflower. Do we really look at it with eyes of understanding? Do we see its complexity? Do we take sufficient notice of its patterns that are staggering in their simple beauty as well as complexity? If this is what Blake is saying, then maybe he is addressing true religion in the sense that it is the entryway to compassion for our fellow human beings. Do we really listen and observe? Do we not only accept others, but appreciate them, their suffering, and their passions? Do we look past the smoke screen that surrounds so many of us and thereby behold the pure essence of God? In Simone Weil's classic book, Waiting for God, she talks about the legend of the Holy Grail. Coming from the Catholic perspective, she defines the Holy Grail as, quote, the miraculous vessel that satisfies all hunger by virtue of the consecrated host, end quote. This reference to communion may be what we're talking about when we talk about spirituality, seeking the satisfaction of our hunger for connection. Communion, coming together, intimate fellowship, rapport with God. To quote Bay again, it is said that the grail belongs to the first comer who asks the guardian of the vessel, who just happens to be a king, three quarters paralyzed by the most painful wound, what are you going through? The love of our neighbor in all its fullness, thus our love for God, simply means being able to say to him, what are you going through? That's the end of her quote. When we are able to look at a man or woman and know the affliction they are feeling, we are looking through eyes of light and thus understand how to behold them. This, I believe, is the realm of spirituality, looking at the flower and beholding its glorious design, its intrinsic beauty, and being humbled by what we see, for we see into the mystery of what is called God. Standing back to observe it enhances the ability to look and see what is not seen at first glance. This deep act of contemplation requires something active and substantial, a willingness to look beyond and into and through, a willingness to behold with different eyes. In this act of compassion, we move beyond mere contemplation into the act of receiving. As Simone Weil says once again, the beauty of the world is almost the only way by which we can allow God to penetrate us. It is Christ's tender smile for us coming through matter. End quote. Are not human beings also the beauty of the world, their essence being Christ's tender smile right there in front of us? For a period of about 20 years, I left the Mormon Church and searched for the presence of Spirit in such places as Catholic Mass, at Pentecostal gatherings, at First, Second, and Calvary Baptist meetings, at Unity, Church of Religious Science, megachurch meetings, and in gatherings with charismatic Christians, Episcopalians, Methodists, Lutherans, Unitarians, African Methodists, Episcopalians. In the jungles of Ecuador, the mountains of Peru, I chanted with shamans in their ceremonies and drank their potions. In the remote hills of the Ozarks, inside a tiny Baptist church, I witnessed a young boy in black and white Oxfords being saved. In the Yucatan, with a group of goddess and embryo devotees, I climbed stone-carved steps built 4 feet half my size to the top of towering Mayan temples to consider the cosmos from this ancient perspective. In the Indian state of Sikkim at the Rumtek Monastery, I sat across from a monk from Bhutan for lessons in Tibetan Buddhism 101. Sometimes I wondered if I was merely a window shopper or a tourist of the exotic in my longing for a spiritual home. But I learned a few things along the way. Number one, I discovered I was, and still am, a mere beginner taking baby steps in the ancient business of understanding spirit, or the divine. So many had gone before me, so many had walked the path, some limping on crutches, some crawling on their knees. Two, regardless of the religious leanings of the people I met, many in these non-LDS settings were tuned into this thing called spirit and holiness and reverence, some to a much greater degree than I'd known before. I came to understand that I could never totally understand another spiritual perspective if I wasn't at its center. Standing on the outside looking in is not sufficient witness to the finely woven web of the theology or purpose of another group of spiritual seekers or worshipers. I consider it very glib to reduce another religion to a few sound bites. Three, I discovered many names for spirit: God, Elohim, Yahweh, Allah, the ineffable, the force, the I am self, the great spirit, divine power, higher power, the great architect. Many seekers for thousands of years have sought a name for this Holy Spirit and a connection to a unified feeling of life. Most of us here today were raised with the embodied God of Mormonism. Some with literal minds scoff at the idea of God being anything that might hint of the amorphous. But after entertaining other definitions of God and being in touch with my own life experience, I sense an energy field that runs through all and everything, spirit infusing the air. The Doctrine and Covenants speaks of the nature of God about which we're not always mindful in our literal mindedness. He comprehendeth all things, and all things are before him, and all things are round about him, and he is above all things, and in all things, and is through all things, and is round about all things. And all things are by him and of him, even God, forever and ever. Number four, I was surprised to find, because sinners and transgressors are supposed to be cut off from God in their wrongfulness, that during my long-term hiatus from the Mormon context, I nonetheless felt followed, even inhabited, definitely surrounded by spirit. I kept catching glimpses of spirit in those ineffable places where one feels connected to others, to nature, and to the ethereal. God was always there, though I didn't always return the invitation. This led me to think of spirituality as a matter of circularity, a giving and a receiving, which is an opening to God's abundance, and thus a giving back. Finally, I came to respect the fact that most of us don't have enough maturity or humility to understand pure religion, true spirituality, or God in our finite state. Though I'm grateful that my Mormon upbringing gave me walking shoes in which I could follow the path into the invisible and toward the great perhaps. When I have felt filled with the Spirit in whatever setting and with whomever people, I have a most beneficent, loving feeling for everything and everyone. All around me is full and complete. I see more profoundly. I'm an electric plug connected to a power source. When this light fills my body, it creates a second sight. An Eskimo story explains the origin of this light as follows. In the eternal darkness, the crow, unable to find any food, longed for light, and the earth was illumined. This is also written about beautifully in D&C 88. If your eye be single to my glory, your whole body shall be filled with light. Spirituality is a sense of being part of the universe in a deep, enfolded, embraced way. It is the impulse behind charity, behind religion. It is a longing for God, a continuation of the divine circle between God's gifts and our reception of them. Spirit waits for and welcomes our longing.
I appreciate being invited to participate in this panel and would like to focus my remarks on the difference between religion and spirituality, at least as we normally talk about them. Before the modern era, the distinction between religion and spirituality was considered a difference without a distinction. Before the 20th century, these terms tended to be used interchangeably. However, with the advent of modern science, an increasingly secular society, a more educated intellectual populace, and the expansion of media to highlight internecine and interreligious conflict around the world, thus increasing the negative associations with religion, the separation between these two words and the cognitive and emotional as well as social and spiritual states they represent has been both sharpened and widened. According to a study conducted by the Pew Trust, millennials increasingly identify themselves as spiritual as opposed to religious. Currently, more than a fifth of Americans use this term to describe themselves when presented with a choice between the two. Further, many emphasize the distinction by claiming not only what they are, spiritual, but what they are not, religious. While in general I consider the distinction somewhat useful, I also feel it is a false dichotomy. My experience teaches me that one can be both religious and spiritual simultaneously. That is, I regularly go to church, participate in religious rituals, practices, and devotional activities. These include regular attendance at ward council, holding weekly coordinating meetings with the missionaries, teaching the gospel principles class, cleaning the chapel, attending priesthood meetings, etc. These are essentially religious activities. At the same time, any one of these activities or experiences may be, but often does not have, what I would consider a spiritual element. That is, I often perform them pretty much like I do many of the other personal and professional parts of my life, routinely, without much thought as to whether they are religious or spiritual. Other activities that take place at church, such as partaking of the sacrament, listening to an inspired speaker or teacher, singing the hymns and listening to sacred music, may be spiritual or have a spiritual component. At the same time, I wouldn't consider them non-religious. Conversely, when I read the scriptures at home, listen to sacred music, walk in nature, attend a play or a concert, or say my nightly prayers, those are usually, but not always, spiritual as opposed to religious expressions. The question that seems appropriate for me is not whether one of these is better or more desirable than the other, but rather what the quality is of both our religious and our spiritual lives as we seek to integrate them. Another way to put this is how can we be both more religious and more spiritual at the same time, balancing the relationship between the two so that we can be the best spiritual / religious persons possible. Religion without spirituality, like faith without works and vice versa, can accomplish much good in the world, but not nearly as much as when they are joined and coherently balanced. It is fashionable these days to see spirituality in an essentially positive light and religion in an essentially negative light. This can be seen in the following epigraph by Sri Chinmoy. The essence of religion, fear God and obey God. The quintessence of spirituality, love God and become another God. This may have a particular relevance to Mormonism, which tends to place a stronger emphasis on fear and obedience and then on love, and whose ultimate objective is to help us to become like God. Another way to consider the distinction between the two is to think of one as human religion and the other as divine religion, although again, it is sometimes difficult, if not impossible, and also may perhaps not desirable, to separate the human from the divine. Given the nature of religious organizations, it is perhaps inevitable that we are more inclined to see, quote-unquote, religion as negative, that is, large organizations representing diverse religious and spiritual ideologies and associated with churches, mosques, synagogues, temples, and ashrams are more likely to come in conflict with one another than individuals of differing religious spiritual convictions. One way to think about these categories is to consider the impact on the world if we had only one of them. That is, if we were only just spiritual or only just religious. What would a world with religion but without spirituality be like? What would a world with spirituality but without religion look like? Perhaps another way to ask the question is this. When was the last time you heard about a group of religious people getting together to have a revelation? Or conversely, when was the last time you heard of a group of spiritual people getting together to organize a soup kitchen and feed the poor, or organize a shipment of humanitarian goods to victims of an earthquake or a tsunami? I've been reading an interesting book, Philip Gully's If the Church Were Christian, Recovering the Values of Jesus. His chapter titles highlight the difference, often the difference and often the deep conflict in Christianity between religion and spirituality. Here, keep in mind, these are his chapter headings, but think about how they might apply to Mormonism. If the Mormon Church were more Christian, affirming our potential would be more important than condemning our brokenness. If the Mormon Church were more Christian, reconciliation would be valued over judgment. Gracious behavior would be more important than right belief. Inviting questions would be more valued than supplying questions. If the Mormon Church were more Christian, encouraging personal exploration would be more important than communal uniformity. Meeting needs would be more important than maintaining institutions. Peace would be more important than power. If the Mormon Church were more Christian, it would care more about love and less about sex. And this life would be more important than the afterlife. When any church is less Christian, according to Gully, it tends to claim spiritual supremacy based on, quote, again, think here of Mormonism, an unbroken chain of apostolic succession or an interruption and restoration of that, a literal reading of an inerrant Bible or an insight gained in a moment of spiritual enlightenment, and a claim to know the heart and mind of Jesus and his hope for the church, end of quote. He concludes, quote, if the church claims Jesus as its founder, it should at least share his values. It seems arrogant for any of us to suggest that we alone have most accurately discerned the true intentions of Jesus. This is always the great temptation. End of quote. The difference between religion and spirituality for Mormons might be seen in the distinction between the following two statements. One, I'm keeping all of the commandments as perfectly as I can so I can get to the celestial kingdom. Two, I don't think much about what kingdom I'm going to in the next world. I just want to work side by side with Jesus. That was all then. Perhaps it's also helpful to consider the extremes of both religion and spirituality, although I suspect that some would quarrel about whether it's possible to have extreme spirituality. One commentator put it this way, quote, religion gone bad results in the triumph of form over content, resulting in rituals without meaning and an exaltation of dogma. Spirituality, at its worst, is mindless drivel, the egotism of the individual believer, even madness. End of quote. In Latter-day Saint practice, these differences between extreme religion and true spirituality can be seen in the following anecdotes. A young man who in childhood had become completely bald as a result of an autoimmune disorder, but who nevertheless never abandoned his wish to go on a mission. is told by a state president that because the wig he wears to cover his baldness does not conform to missionary standards, he will not be allowed to serve a mission. True story. This is the second story. Before there was a temple in the East, a young couple, a Wadanazank couple, took the train from Washington, D.C. to Salt Lake City to be married in the temple. When they got here, somehow, along the way, they had lost their recommends. So they went to the temple, and the temple president, as is traditional practice, tried to reach their bishop and state president to ascertain whether or not they held current recommends. He couldn't reach them, so he sent them over to the church office building. The receptionist looked around for somebody to send them to, and fortunately, President Brown's office was open. So they went to see President Brown. He sat down. He talked to them. He wrote out temple recommends for them, signed them, embraced them, and said, "In this church, we believe in breaking rules, not hearts." Would that more of us believe that? My contention is that the world needs both religion and spirituality in the best manifestations and expressions of each. One could argue that Jesus took pains in his teachings to emphasize both. That is, he came to establish a religion and a church through which that religion could be lived, and at the same time taught timeless and spiritual principles by which both individuals and the church itself should govern their individual and collective behaviors. Perhaps in the next world, there will not be a demarcation between religion and spirituality. But this is the world in which we live and move and have our being, and therefore the one in which we must work out our salvation through both religious and spiritual expressions, that is, with fear and trembling, which are more closely associated with religion, and work out our salvation with love and compassion, which are more closely associated with spirituality. Perhaps the ultimate coming together of religion and spirituality can be seen in the sacrament of the Lord's Supper. My guess is that for most of us on most Sundays, partaking of the shard of bread and the small vessel of water is a religious experience. We do it rather routinely, often distracted by the cares and burdens of our lives, thinking about something someone just said, or the spilled Cheerios or the last message we need to look at before shutting off our cell phones. But on some Sundays, we bring our burdens, and during the sacrament, we lay them at the foot of the cross. And we look up at that man of sorrows, and placing a small piece of bread on our tongues, remember his broken body. And as we drink the small cup of water, remember his blood shed in Gethsemane and on the cross. And something both breaks within us and mysteriously is healed and made whole. And love fills our hearts, and gratitude floods our bodies. And we are, at least for those small moments, spiritual beings. And if we can carry some of that love and gratitude into the hours and days of our lives, our religious life will become seamless with our spiritual life and be considered equally important component and give us a taste of what our eternal lives might be. Thank you.
Thank you for having me today. It's an honor to be here with these wonderfully articulate and insightful people. The idea of being spiritual but not religious is one that I've heard a lot of my friends say. But it's never been something that has resonated with my experience, and that's probably because I've spent a lot of time wrestling with the opposite problem, that of being religious but not spiritual. I want to talk a little bit about what that means from a personal perspective, share my story of how I came to a place of more spiritual connectedness, and then perhaps try to explore some of the implications or ideas that I have about what spirituality is and how religion can help or hinder it. To begin with, maybe I'll throw out a working definition of spirituality. It obviously defies definition, as we've talked about here today, but perhaps spirituality means connection. Perhaps spirituality means being connected to that transcendent thing that can only be experienced. Different people have different words for this. I call it God. And you can find God out there. You can find God in the people around you. And you can find God within. I was raised in a pretty strict Mormon home. We were the kind of people who had scripture study, family prayer, and family home evening on a regular basis. On Sundays, we had to wear our church clothes all day and could not go outside to play with our friends. I turned 16 right before the high school homecoming dance, so fortunately this wasn't an issue. But in conversations I had with my mother, she told me that if my birthday had come even one day after the dance, she wouldn't let me go because that would be being disobedient. So I grew up thinking that obeying the rules was the secret to being connected to God. And, you know, for the most part, that was all right with me. My personality is such that I don't really like to kick against the pricks or stir the pot. I saw what was expected of me, and I genuinely wanted to fulfill it as best I could. In fact, I am what you might call a recovering perfectionist. And through the combination of my family's and Mormonism's emphasis on obedience and my own personality traits, I developed something of a love affair with rules. They became the foundation of my spiritual life. And rules are, they really are quite wonderful, you see. They're objective, they're concrete. If I wonder how I'm doing, I can simply think of the rule and then evaluate my performance based on it. I really bought into the idea that if I could just obey the rules perfectly enough, I would be a spiritual giant. Of course, there's a downside to rules. Because they're objective and concrete, the very things I love so much about them, they're inflexible and hard. The evaluation process that I love so much for its efficiency also proved to be quite discouraging. It turns out I never measured up quite as well as I thought that I should. I developed a fairly severe anxiety related to my personal righteousness. I never felt worthy. I lacked peace. I experienced increasing doubts about the things that I believed and had been taught. I prayed mightily to feel the burning in the bosom, confirming that everything that I had learned was true, but I never experienced it. And of course, I blamed the doubts on the fact that I couldn't do everything perfectly, and so my solution was to double down again and to try to do everything perfectly. I resented the people around me who seemed to be carefree and not nearly as concerned about the rules as I was. I judged them. And so ironically, but perhaps not surprisingly, all my efforts to grow closer to God took me further and further away. I was devout but disconnected, a whited sepulcher. I was religious but not spiritual. When I was in my late 20s, it reached a breaking point. I still had deep doubts, but I refused to acknowledge them. But then I had an experience, a profound spiritual experience, and I want to share a short blog post I wrote about the experience for Doves and Serpents. It had been a miserable 5 years. I'd returned home from my mission in July 2004. My mission was a furnace. White-hot anxiety and hungry red zeal drew me into a desperate blaze of obedience and fervor. Like all zeal, mine was born of fear. Fear that what I believed wasn't true, that I was on the wrong track, that the tremendous efforts I'd made my entire life to control my actions and monitor my thoughts were in vain. I couldn't face that possibility. So I thrust in my sickle with my might. I hoped that if I could just use that phrase enough, I know, I would finally convince myself that I did. I'd obeyed every rule, knocked thousands of doors, had hundreds of discussions, memorized dozens of scriptures, and day after day, contact over after contact, the words had fallen out of my mouth in a downpour of piety. I know, I know. I know. I know the Book of Mormon is the Word of God. I know that Joseph Smith was a true prophet. I know that if you stop drinking coffee, you will be happier and healthier than you are today. It had almost worked. I'd returned home almost sure. The nagging doubts that had driven me into the mission field now hummed quietly below the surface, unacknowledged, neglected. Strange thoughts I could not explain, but vowed never again to entertain seriously. It was Satan's influence, I reasoned, one of the devil's dirty tricks. It was an odd thing to take comfort in, but I did. The devil is inside my mind. I must never let him out. But keeping Satan at bay was easier on the mission than it was in real life. On the mission, you had one focus, teach the gospel. You locked your life to anything else. You opened your mouth, and it was filled with reassuring platitudes, safely scripted replies, even the occasional flash of insight that felt as if it couldn't possibly have come from you. At home, you were surrounded by distractions, books, school, friends, boyfriends, then eventually husband, work, mortgage, child. The safety died. 5 years have passed since my mission, and slowly but surely, Satan had weaseled his way back into the forefront of my mind. Doubt swirled around me like a country twister. Snippets of questions hurtling back past too quickly to see or grasp. I could make out just one question in the storm over and over in a million different varieties. What if? 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 Until tonight. The night I found myself in my kitchen alone again long after the family had gone to bed. The refrigerator hummed menacingly and I kicked it in a vain attempt to silence it. Then I opened it, searching for comfort, and snapped it closed, unfulfilled. Exhausted, I sank to my knees by the sink. Dear God, I pray, I don't know what more you want from me, but I'm so damned sick of this. The ice maker gurgled. What else am I supposed to do, God? I've done everything you wanted. I've fasted, I've prayed, I served a mission, I married in the temple, and still I doubt. Either take these doubts away from me or I'm done. Do you hear me, God? I'm done. Silence descended. As if in deference to my agony, the refrigerator stopped its incessant hum. It was just enough time for me to whisper the words I had never dared admit to anyone, especially myself. I don't know if any of this is real, including you. As soon as the confession left my lips, warmth radiated through my body. Just like I'd promised every investigator on my mission, just like I'd asked for a million times in desperate, tear-filled prayers. I doubt, God. I doubt. I don't know a damn thing. Now I was laughing, giddy with freedom. I don't know if you're there. I don't know what any of this means. And the more I said it, the more it filled me, that burning in the bosom, that unbridled peace. It had been a miserable 5 years. There was more misery to come. You don't tear apart your worldview without consequence. But looking back on it, I say that was the day I really met God. A God of love. A loyal God. A God who is more interested in my truth, not the truth I expected to learn. There are a couple things I take from my experience. First, it's that spirituality is honest. It's able to deal with the truth, even when the truth is messy, difficult, ambiguous, unflattering, and imperfect. There's a quote by Byron Katie that I really like. She says, "Don't be spiritual, be honest instead." When you're religious but not spiritual, you're very concerned with the outward appearance. You want to make sure that the I's are dotted and the T's are crossed. You want to show up with the right smile on your face, the right clothes on your body, the right words on your lips. But if those things don't come from a genuine place, what you're doing is constructing barriers between yourself and God. That's because God deals in realness. Our Mormon tradition has wonderful language to express this concept. The Book of Mormon puts it this way, "Behold, the Spirit speaketh truth and lieth not. Wherefore, it speaketh of things as they really are, and of things as they really will be." C.S. Lewis wrote a book, probably his best, called Till We Have Faces. I really resonate with its message. In it, the main character writes a complaint against the gods. They've wronged her. They've ruined her life. And this is the story she believes about her own experience. At the end of the book, she has a profound experience where she actually meets a god. She recognizes that the story she's told herself isn't true, that she's been selfish and jealous. She stops deceiving herself and has a moment of transcendent connection, and she says, "How can the gods meet us face to face until we have faces?" C.S. Lewis later shared what he meant by this. He said, "A person must be speaking with its own voice, not one of its borrowed voices, expressing its actual desires, not what it imagines it desires, being good or ill itself, not any mask." In other words, before we can experience spiritual communion, we must come as we are. I think this is because who we are is itself divine. A second question that I'm driven to ask based on my experience is, how does religion interact in the spiritual life? We've seen that it can be a terrible hindrance. It was for me. So should we just throw it out? Should everyone be spiritual but not religious? I think there are three things that religion does extremely well for spiritual development that we may miss if we abandon it entirely. And first, community. Second, language. And third, practices. Community is important to the spiritual life because it is in community that we discover God in those around us. I believe that the core of spirituality is connection. Christ's intercessory prayer taps into this yearning, that they may all be one, even as you, Father, are in me and I in you, that they may also be in us. The glory which you have given me, I have given to them, that they may be one, just as we are one. The second thing that religion provides is a common language for speaking about spiritual things. God transcends words and descriptions, but as inadequate as it may be, we need to have a common vocabulary to speak about God. Religion provides this vocabulary in ways that are accessible to people from all walks of life and at divergent points on the spiritual journey, and that makes it very valuable. The third thing that religion provides is spiritual practices, ways of experiencing God. Practices dig deeper and go beyond even what vocabulary and language can provide. They facilitate connections to God that are powerful. Some spiritual practices are individual, of course, but communal practices draw us together in tangible ways to remind us that we are all connected. My sister's pastor says it this way: religion is not spirituality. Religion is the home for your spirituality, because ideally, it provides an environment where spirituality can grow and thrive. The problem, of course, arises when the home becomes toxic. Then it can be difficult for anything to grow. In conclusion, I want to say just a few words about Mormonism, since we're all here because of our connection to Mormonism, at least in relation to this question. As for Mormonism, I have hope. All the ingredients are here for a beautiful, transcendent mansion of a home. We are good at community. We have beautiful language to describe God, Mother, Father, Elder Brother. And we have unique and engaging practices that can provide whole-body communal experiences. The trouble I think we have is the same trouble that I experienced, and that is, as an institution, as a body, we are not totally honest yet. We have yet to remove the mask and stand as we are, warts and all. We cling to a shiny PR image and shove difficult truths under the rug. And I think I see improvements in this regard, but I pray for the moment that we will just tear the mask off like a band-aid, if I can mix my metaphors, and begin to move toward connection, messy and wonderful as it always is. Thank you again for the opportunity to be here with all of you today. It's been a wonderful treat. Thank you.
Been a wonderful session so far, and we do have some time for your comments, if you can keep them brief, or questions that you might have for the panelists. We ask, so that these can be recorded, that you would come up and use one of the microphones. Now, all of three of these are live right now, but this one is not yet on. We'll put this one on the prime. Okay, go ahead. I'll be happy to hand this to anyone who wants to come.
What brought you to the session? You know, why took this one?
Dan asked, what brought you to the session? Why did you pick this one? That inspires anyone to take time.
All agrees.
Yeah. I respond to Dan just because I'll always answer any question Dan asks to the best of my ability. I have in my life occasional glimpses of what I feel are spiritual insights or spiritual connections, and I feel I don't have enough of that in my life, and I just hope to fertilize it by catching visions from you people. I respect the three of you that I know a little bit immensely, and I'm really glad to meet you too. And I just feel like the more I hear of other people's experiences, the greater my imagination can be, and I'll have more terms to experience it in. I'm intrigued that you, so many of you, couch these things in terms that other people have used first, but it's not, that doesn't make your experience secondary. but final. So that's.
Let me say a word here. I mentioned millennials, and many of you are aware that there is a what is characterized as a faith crisis within Mormonism, that there seem to be an increasing number of people who are making an exodus from Mormonism. And I had a former member of my ward who sent me something from India this morning that I thought was really interesting. It's not Indian, but it's nevertheless wise. An article by Rachel Evans, Why Millennials Are Leaving the Church, and she's an evangelical. And she goes through a number of things that she says she's talked to a number of pastors and about what's really happening with millennials. And then their response is, oh, we need to get a better jazz band, or we need to serve latte in the thing. Yeah, that's what you're really asking. And then she writes this at the end of this. What millennials really want from the church is not a change in style, but a change in substance. We want an end to the culture wars. We want a truce between science and faith. We want to be known for what we stand for, not what we are against. We want to ask questions that don't have predetermined answers. We want churches that emphasize an allegiance to the kingdom of God over an allegiance to a single political party or a single nation. We want our LGBT friends to feel truly welcome in our faith communities. We want to be challenged to live lives of holiness, not only when it comes to sex, but also when it comes to living simply, caring for the poor and oppressed, pursuing reconciliation, engaging in creation, in creation care, and becoming peacemakers. You can't hand us a latte and then go about business as usual and expect us to stick around. We're not leaving the church because we don't find the cool factor there. We're leaving the church because we don't find Jesus in it. Like every generation before ours, and every generation after, deep down, we long for Jesus. Now, these trends are obviously not true only for millennials, but also for many folks from other generations. Whenever I write about this topic, I hear from 40-somethings and grandmothers, Generation Xers and retirees, who send me messages all in caps that read, "Me too." So I don't want to portray the divide as wider than it is, but I would encourage church leaders eager to win millennials back to sit down and really talk to them about what they're looking for, what they would really like to contribute to a faith community. The answers might surprise you. So I think that highlights, to me, some of the conflict between religion and spirituality within Mormonism, that we sometimes put such an emphasis on form, such an emphasis on tradition, such an emphasis on what is true, that people who are coming who may not be satisfied by those forms, who may not themselves be absolutely convinced of what is true, but are looking for something deep, spiritual and connection to Jesus. That might help us as we think about how we do what this lovely woman said about that community and the connectedness.
Would you at least would like to?
Because we have lots of time. This is inspired by something Phyllis said, but I think probably everyone could say something to it. And also, it spawns another maybe related question. And that is when you're talking about, she talked about like whether that unless you're within, say, a faith community, you were really in no position to speak to it in some ways. And then that implied that if you were within it, then you maybe shared something. And I guess, because a lot of times within Mormonism, I don't feel like I share very much with the people in the pews. I wonder, a spiritual thing, can you really know what other people, you know, it is what I call spiritual, and when I use that term and when I experience it, is it very much like with the people in my pews or the Catholic pews or the people who say they're spiritual, but not religious. I mean, or William Blake, or you know, how similar is that? And then that also made me wonder. And I don't know which of you, we haven't really spoken to this, and this is maybe very non-spiritual, but I'm really interested in neuroscience. And with what I think Phyllis said, it's been, we're not the first to go on faith journey. People for millennia have been doing this. But what's changed now is what we can do with science and the mind, and we have a long ways to go still with that. But I wonder, do you think we'll get to a point where we can do some real, scientific studies that study this topic of spirituality, or will it always be beyond that, and we can't ever pin it down?
Question.
Don't quite know how to answer you, but Ken Wilber has written a book called Marriage of Sense and Soul, which is talking about this, the science and religion and how they don't understand each other. And he had some suggestions of how they fit together, which I didn't totally agree with, but it's a very, I think there is an effort to try to bridge these things and to bring them together. That may not be
on the words or design. There's two questions. Well, just to let you guys know, I think it'd be fair for me to say there is a neuroscience and religion group formed here in Salt Lake City. So we've met about four or five times. If you're interested, Facebook me, Dan Lishman, and it's a Facebook group that we kind of communicate with each other. We've taken a couple of months off, but Michael Ferguson, who's a neuroscience PhD, brain imaging guy at the UVU, Lisa Prager, who's a musician, started with Mystic. There's me kind of come through religious studies and things like that. There's four followers that kind of seem to dominate the discussion, but there's about 40 or 50 people that get together. We're at least playing with us. When are you in town? But a couple of people joined us through Skype, so there's a possibility.
Okay.
So if anyone wants to know about that, there's at least that piece. But are you talking about will it ever explain it away? Because there, I think Ken Wilber does help. Ken's an interesting guy, he's a controversial fellow. But he puts electrodes on his head, and he can show you through meditation he can quiet parts of his brain. And he works in alpha and whatever the different ones are, things like this. And it's sort of a show-offy, weird thing, but yet in some ways he is kind of demonstrating that he can do through practice what like the Persinger helmet can do, because you all know that there's that helmet that they can change different things in there and they can produce a spiritual experience within you, and or they can make you paranoid or something like that just through the magnetic fields that they're doing. And I think Kent is pretty solid ground. He says something like, of course anything's going to map out your brain. Your brain is one of the main intermediaries between you and this wider field and things like that. And so just because somebody can deliberately produce something within your brain doesn't mean, because you're not generally, it's more of a spontaneous experience that happens to you there. So any spiritual experience, of course, is going to show up and light up different parts of, the MRI or whatever that's being, doing. But I'm not one of these guys that says at some point, you'll have, that spirituality is reduced.
Right. And somebody, like, where are the biology of belief? That sounds like it might be interesting on this. The biology of belief, this woman recommends.
Well, there's certainly, there's lots of books on the planet.
Yeah. Dan mentioned that for 12 years, I no longer do. 12 years, I've worked with a research institute in Santa Cruz Mountains called the Institute of Heart Math. Heart Math really studies the relationship of the heart to the brain, and this dynamic, which has been essentially severed since the 17th century, where we moved lock, stock, and barrel up here. There is a new field called neurocardiology, and one of the things we now understand is that your heart has 40,000 neurons. They're like the neurons in your brain, and that they're always in constant communication, and that our distrust in the sense of the heart is at the heart of, I think, a lot of our current the separation between them. So the work of the Institute of Heart Math is really to teach us about how we can both honor the importance of the heart. The heart produces 5,000 times more electromagnetic energy than the brain does. It is the most powerful oscillator within our entire systems. It has the ability to bring the other systems within synchronization. And J.D. Cunningham wrote a little epigraph about Sir Thomas More that illustrates what I think happened in the modern world. On this scaffold, Sir Thomas More lies dead, who would not cut the heart from the head. King Henry did it for him, but we ourselves have separated from that. And so listening to our hearts, understanding that there is, and one of the things that Institute of Heart Math stand out, along with a number of other people doing scientific research on this, is that the heart has both a kind of cognitive function. What does Jesus say? As a person thinks in his heart, ponder it in your heart, consider it in your heart. What does this mean? Well, it means that our heart has the ability to understand, it has a certain memory capacity, it has something that allows us to understand things that we don't understand here. And it's when the two talk to one another, each has a greater chance of fulfilling its function, but it's in that wholeness. And it's so interesting that I did it before I left Heart Math. I did a webinar called The Heart and the World Religions, and all religions, see, the heart is at the center. And Robert Frost said, we dance around in the ring and suppose the secret sits in the middle of the nose. Loretta, let's hear from you.
Well, I was touched by Kay's honesty. And I have two questions. You don't have to answer the second one if it's too personal. What are the impediments to honesty? Why do we wear masks? And the second question is, what has been the reaction of your honesty, particularly about your feelings about spirituality and about institutional religion, when you broach the subject, as you did here with us today?
Good questions, thank you. The first question, why do we wear masks? Correct? That was the question? Why do we wear masks? I've thought a lot about this, and I think that the primary reason, or at least in my experience, the primary reason is because we are invested in an identity or a sense of self that we feel gives us value. And we can take our cues from our families, we can take our cues from our culture, we can take it from our religious community. But in my experience anyway, I felt that I was valuable if I conformed to X, Y, Z, and so I did everything that I could to portray that and to be that and to demonstrate that thing that I thought would make me acceptable. And I think that to a certain extent, self-awareness, honesty, going down the path of self-acceptance involves recognizing that you're valuable because you are. You know, you're valuable because you are, you have God within you. And that when you can strip away, the things that are preventing you from reaching down and finding that core aspect of who you are, that piece of the divine that rests in the center of who you are, then, you know, those until you can get rid of those things, you'll constantly be in a state of frustration and deception and stuff like that. And that's my experience. I don't know if other people have had a similar one. The second question is how have I been received since being more?
How has it increased the messiness of your life?
Oh, it's much messier. It's wonderful. Yeah, I mean, you know, honesty sucks sometimes. Like, things are crappy, and that's a big, you know, life's a bitch, and then you die. I don't know. But the point is that I'm at peace. The point is I no longer spend time worrying about this thing or that thing, and did I do this right, did I do that right? You know what I mean? Like, even when I make a mistake, and I do, like, all the time, constantly, make gazillions of mistakes, all the, you know, I'm okay with that. Other people, for the most part, I found actually are really comfortable with that too. Like when you show up as yourself, I found that you also give space for other people to show up as themselves, and they appreciate that. Now there are some people who I found are still so invested perhaps in the false identity that they've created that they're uncomfortable by someone who shows up as themselves. And that's okay. You know what I mean? Like it's up to me to give them space to be where they are on their journey. And it's up to me to say, well, you know, that person looks like they're in pain, but I will be kind to that person. I will show acceptance of that person exactly where they are, the spot that they're on their journey. But I don't need them to agree with me. I don't need them to, to come to the same conclusions that I do, because I'm okay with where I am. Does that make sense?
And would you please come up with Sylvia, please?
This is on. Okay. I'm a first-time attendee, and I was so thrilled to see Aubrey's last night because I've read all your writings. I'm from the Bay Area. I grew up there. I just have to say, yesterday I always felt you're like the generation, right? I'm not a millennial. I'm the end of the baby boomers. I don't know what you are. I know. You're just ahead of your time. I think you're the light for your generation, is what I would think. So I just want to say, I don't know why I'm even standing up here, but yesterday, just an omen, I've never attended this. I know Toby Henry, I grew up in the state. We were in the same work building. Those of you who know Toby Henry and Phyllis and Henry. And I love them. They were my leader. They were adult leaders. They were involved in a lot. So I came here because of them, and because I feel like I'm realizing that I've been a gay magnet all my life, and so my yesterday, this is an omen for the first day of Sunstone, my boyfriend from BYU confirmed me as a friend on Facebook, who is been on a mission and is gay and living a gay life, so, and I just love everything you've said and written, and I'm so glad I was living in Park City and not in California during Prop 8. I would have been with Steve Young's wife, and posting my note or something. I wouldn't even been able. So I want to ask you, what you were saying, the heart map, the heart having all these sensories and the mind, and you being Mormon and being bringing up the spirituality, which I love what you also, because I feel like you speak to a really society age group of women. And but Bob, where's the spirit? So you've got the heart. You've got the mind. Where does our spirit reside? That's my question. And I know it's your opinion, person.
I didn't plan to have to say anything she said. What does the scripture say? The spirit, I think if a Latter-day Saint theology, the spirit is wherever we find it, in us, in other people, in the world. The spirit is ubiquitous. God is ubiquitous. Not that we believe in the amorphous presence of God in that sense, but that we believe the spirit of Christ is in all things. And even as I say that, those words, I feel the spirit of Christ. We find it in any place I think we honestly look for. God is there. Even in the dark places, even in the doubting places, God's Spirit is always available. God is always present, if we are present. So we sometimes think that the only place we can find God is in our church. I teach at Graduate Theological Union in Berkeley, and my students are students from all over, all denominations. Jesuits, Franciscans, Episcopalians, even Wiccans, whatever, they all come. And I find myself feeling their spirituality. I mentioned yesterday that, and I will just take a minute to say this, one of the brightest students I've had. I've taught tens of thousands of students in my lifetime. And I had a Jesuit student 2 years ago, Glenn Butterworth, who studied for priesthood. And when he graduated this June, he had his ordination ceremony in Los Angeles, and he asked me to come and participate, or to observe it. So I went. It's a beautiful big church with all of the wonderful high church things that that I find really resonant. I'm a closet Episcopalian. As I'm listening and watching this ceremony, these five men who prostrate themselves before the altar, completely lay down, and then who come up, are ordained, and 100 or more Jesuit priests come and lay their hands on all five of them. So there's this very interesting ceremony that I've never seen before. And then these new priests, after being ordained, have their vestments put on. And then they do the sacrament. And I feel very comfortable taking the Eucharist or the sacrament in the churches. And so when it was my time to go up, I went up, and there standing is my student who hands me the wafer. And when I take that wafer, I feel this as an emblem that binds me to Christ in the same way that I partake the emblem of the sacrament. And then after the ceremony, and everyone's gone out to have lunch, Glenn is still, I look for him, and I find him there standing with his mother and his old girlfriend. And I say to his mother, "Your son, of all the thousands of students I've taught, is one of the brightest that I've ever had. He's also one of the morally best." And he said, "I'm so touched by what you said, and so touched that you would come to my ceremony." And I said, I wouldn't have missed it. And he said, "Can I give you a blessing?" And I said, "I would be honored if you did." So this Jesuit priest gave me a blessing, which I felt connected me to him and to God and to everyone in that building and everyone in my ward and everyone in the whole world. And I think that's what spirituality is when we find that, as this lovely woman said, when we find that connectedness wherever we find.
We're about out of time, but I suspect the panelists might be willing to hang around a little bit if you want to talk to them. This has been, I think, a really wonderful session, and I'm so appreciated for thank you for sharing some of your experiences and the feelings with us, and I appreciate your opinion too. Thank you.